From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. We celebrate a very different pair of holidays on our show today. Father's Day fast approaches. Have you gotten your dad a gift yet?
You know, every year my kids make a big deal over Father's Day and give me the same BS gift. I don't get excited. It's going to be some stupid sock with some paint on it, and I got to put it on. Oh, man, y'all did it again.
And Sunday is also Juneteenth. That's a day to remember the contributions of black slaves in America. We mark both occasions later this hour. First, though, the weekend is almost here. Let's talk about music. Earlier this week, we added to our Georgia playlist series with picks from music festival founder Tim Sweetwood. He talked about his appreciation for the Allman Brothers and Savannah metal band Baroness.
It's got elements of a deep purple in there. It's got the metal side where I can hear the lyrics. I've never been a Cookie Monster fan of lyrics. It's got a few of the breakdowns that you can think of where it hits hard, but then it goes back to that melodic sound. I'll find it
every day. The Georgia Playlist is a collaborative effort, and we always ask you for your nominations for songs that best represent the Peach State. So here are your first thoughts. Lee Fields did something a little different. Lee wrote to us about David Barbie. He's the director of the Music Business Certificate Program at the University of Georgia. Lee says David, who is also a musician, should be the next person we call on for Georgia Playlist selections. So, thanks for the idea, Lee. We will see if David is game. And David, if you're listening, you've been called out. We want to know what you think. You can call us at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter at OST Talk or post to Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. If you need a good laugh after this week, you're in luck. The second annual Atlanta Improv Festival kicked off yesterday, and it runs through Saturday night. The festival's headliner is Quartet. Quartet is a Chicago-based group that features actor and comedian Jack McBrayer. He's best known for his role as Kenneth on the TV show 30 Rock.
Mr. Jordan, I cannot work with that machine at my desk.
But you can have coffee anytime you want.
I don't drink coffee, sir. I don't drink hot liquids of any kind. That's the devil's temperature.
Jack McBrayer was born in Macon and grew up in Conyers, Georgia. And we spoke with him back in April when he was in town for the Atlanta Film Festival. I started with a question about how Hollywood portrays the South. He agreed it's not always kind.
True, true. This is true. And I mean, I could just be as guilty as anybody for some of that. But I do have to say one thing that's a little more glaring to me, just as a viewer, sometimes the accents are the things that make my skin crawl a little bit more. When you have a non-Southern actor, which, you know, God bless, we all have to do our job. But sometimes when they have to put on a Southern accent that they may not be as familiar with, sometimes that requires a little more forgiveness than I'm prepared for.
I assume you may be talking about accents that we've heard, perhaps on something like House of Cards.
I'm not allowed to mention names. Come on, Hollywood's a small town.
But have you ever been asked to either pump up your accent for effect or tone it down?
Tone it down. I don't think anyone has ever asked me to pump up my Southern accent. I don't think they would understand the words coming out of my mouth.
You mean your accent can get stronger?
Well, you know, when you're drunk, tired, or angry. Well, when you go back home for Christmas break for a week, you come back and rah, rah, blah, blah, blah. And all your friends back in California are like, what did you just try to communicate? Are you injured?
And yet, to a certain extent, the roles that you get cast in a lot, and I'm thinking a lot, of course, of the role of the page on 30 Rock.
Yeah.
It is a nice side of the South. I mean, I think Wikipedia. I looked at Wikipedia, and they describe you as absurdly cheerful, overly polite.
Yeah, these are all good things as far as I'm concerned.
Right. So that was, in some ways, taking the Southern stereotype and making it positive.
True, that's a good spin. They probably didn't put in Wikipedia that he also comes across as someone who's had a railroad spike put through his head. Not the smartest kid on the block.
Yes, that's true. And I think to a certain extent, Southern accents kind of get that stereotype.
It's true, but you know what? Play your cards right. You can use that to your advantage, too. You get pulled over for a speeding ticket, you just talk real Southern, smile real big, and send you on your way.
I'm I'm sorry. I'm just imagining that in my head.
There you go.
So it's kind of a there are certain tentpole films that people will always associate with the South. I mean, going back as far as Gone with the Wind, there are certain films. Deliverance is one of them. And I wonder, have you seen the portrayal of the South change in the years since you were born, since the 80s and 90s?
Well, that's an interesting question. I guess just it could be such a crapshoot because of, you know, what films are being put out. I am, of course, sensitive to a hugely negative portrayal of the South. But as you can probably understand, too, even Southerners have their distinctions. For example, if you see a movie about, you know, the backwoods swamps of Louisiana, even if it's like horrible things are happening with horrible people in it, we can still kind of distance ourselves going, oh, yeah, well, that's Louisiana. So I think even in the South, we can make these separations. But with that being said, any like trends in terms of depictions of the South, I don't know if necessarily it's evolved, or I think it really is just kind of a luck of the draw of what movies are being produced at whatever time.
And what director chooses.
And what director, exactly what their vision is.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with actor Jack McBrayer, star of 30 Rock and the voice of Fix-It Felix, which is one of my favorite performances in Wreck-It Ralph. You know, I want to kind of talk about some of your voiceover work because you also appeared for at least one episode of Archer, which is made here in Atlanta. You played Randy Gillette, the brother of one of the main characters. Let's hear a clip.
See, me and Janelle got us one of them open marriages, like in France.
Oh, right, in Europe.
And I would really like that open marriage to include Ray's new wife.
What?
Now, look, that's in the Bible.
Really?
Genesis 38, verse 8.
Really?
But even though Ray used to be a preacher, he was never big on the Old Testament.
So that's, they seem to be playing off the fact that that's against the Southern stereotype?
I don't know. Sometimes I show up and cash the check.
Well, that is for an animated show that is definitely not for children. So let's take a listen to some voice work that was definitely for children. This was the role you played in Despicable Me, and we hear Steve Carell's voice as well.
Whoa, 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 whoa. What was that? She hit that. I saw that with my own eyes.
Hey, buddy, let me explain something to you. You see that little tin spaceship? You see how it's not knocked over? Do you know what that means, Professor? It means you don't get the unicorn! Ow! Uh-oh, somebody's got a frowny face. Boom. Better luck next time.
What is the difference in preparation for you if you're doing a voiceover versus actually appearing in 30 Rock or another show?
Well, you are working some different muscles, that's for sure. you know, when you're on a TV or a movie, you know, live action, you do just have to be a little more, strangely, just a little more prepared. With that being said, when I go in for the voiceover and stuff, you are acting up a storm. I'm sitting there, you're moving your arms, you're sweating, you're screaming into a microphone for hours. But it's unique because there's not another person playing against you. Like, for example, Steve Carell was not in the booth when I was recording Despicable Me. You're just reading with the director or just with an engineer. So it's kind of just a different muscle that you're flexing.
And you have to do some lines over and over with different
inflections. Oh, yeah, to the point where sometimes it just doesn't make sense anymore.
Well, then I want to talk about one more, I guess, sort of permutation of your character as an actor, because you appear on the Conan O'Brien show a lot.
Oh, yes.
A lot. So this is from an episode that was filmed on location in Atlanta.
April Fools. You see, I'm afraid I won't be able to make it to the show tonight as I have been in a terrible boating accident and I am currently in the hospital.
Oh, okay, Jack. Well, that's a great April Fools joke.
Thank you.
You're welcome. It's just that the thing is, you said April Fools first, which kind of gives it away. That's not how it's done. Also, you're standing right in front of me, so I can see that you're not in the hospital.
Gotcha!
So that is shows you appearing on a talk show as yourself, as Jack McBrayer, but you're clearly playing a character.
Well, story of my life, dear. Story of my life.
Don't you ever just want to go into Conan and just sit down and be smart?
If only I could. No, of course, he loves the fact that I'm a Southerner. With that being said, Conan loves the South. He's a huge history buff. For his honeymoon, he and his wife took a tour of Georgia and hit, like, Civil War, battleground sites and hit all these museums and stuff. But I think he gets a real kick out of the fact that I can pretty easily slip into a local yokel pretty easily. I owe a great deal to that man. So as far as I'm concerned, he can make fun of me till the cows come home.
and I wonder how much you are stuck with Ken the Page for the rest of your acting career. I mean, you were so successful in that role. It's so iconic. Is that always going to shadow you?
Well, if it does, pretty decent shadow to have. That job and that role, it created so many opportunities. I was never asked to do any voiceover stuff until people saw me on 30 Rock playing Kenneth the Page. So I owe a great deal to that, to Tina Fey, who created it. People do ask, like, are you worried about getting typecast and all that kind of thing? And I have a couple different responses, because I think of people like Don Knotts, and I think of people like Bob Newhart, Andy Griffith, Bea Arthur. These are actors who didn't stray too far from, you know, their signature style, and they worked for decades, and they worked very well. So for me, it's not about, like, getting typecast. It's like, let me just get cast, and then I'll worry about type later on.
And I wonder, the success that Georgia has had and becoming what people are calling Yollywood, is such...
I've not heard that.
You had not?
No.
That it's become such a busy place for filming both movies and TV shows. Has that been a surprise for you?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I also am aware just of, you know, the number of years being able to do this is that it is dependent on how long a state can sustain that kind of thing. For example, I know that Michigan had that great tax break for several years, and then sometimes it just goes away. So for me, it's just like, whoa, let's keep this going as long as we can, as long as it's benefiting, you know, the most people. So I hope it goes on forever and ever. But plus, I'll tell you what, I can't get work there to save my life.
In Georgia?
But no, ma'am. I've yet to be asked. Come on, Yollywood.
Yollywood. That's insane.
I know, right? Well, I guess they want real life reserves. If they want more hillbillies, they just got pick a
I guess this there. Might be the one time when you might have to pump up your accent.
Oh, that's right. Oh, I'll practice in the mirror right now.
That was my conversation with actor and comedian Jack McBrayer from back in April. Jack will perform with Chicago-based improv group Quartet this Saturday night at the Village Theater. It's part of the Atlanta Improv Festival. We have more information at gpbnews.org. This is On Second Thought. The history of Juneteenth goes like this. President Abraham Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation in 1863. But 2 years later, on June 19th, 1865, slaves in Texas finally got the news that they were free. Juneteenth is this Sunday, but Atlanta's Oakland Cemetery celebrated a few days early this year. Groups of all ages were invited to tour the cemetery's historic African-American gravesites last weekend. Many of them are still unmarked. But Oakland Cemetery staff has made headway in the identification efforts. Producer Sean Powers was there. He brings us this audio postcard.
The African American Burial Ground.
Burial.
Yeah, that. Burial Ground at Oakland Cemetery demonstrates racial segregation in America, in life and in death.
My name is Joshua Julius. I am 9. I'm about to turn 10 in July.
it's important to remember all of them because they could have made a difference. It could have been a small difference or a big difference, but they both made up where we are now. Earn the right to be treated equally with whites, even in death.
So see, that's very good, Joshua. Look at the pictures that are here. See, that young boy may be about your age, and he's drinking from a water fountain. And what does this say?
Colored.
Yeah. So I'm D.L. Henderson, and I'm a volunteer and board member with the Historic Oakland Foundation. Okay, keep looking. Let's see. What do we have here? Can you read that marker? And the kids have a cultural treasure hunt that they're following to look at, to find out all about the historic treasures that are here in the cemetery. Okay, now look at the second question. What's the second question?
It says, most African Americans living in Atlanta were enslaved before the Civil War. Find the grave of someone who was born during slavery before 1866.
Right, so before this... Many of the graves, if you look all around you, you won't see marked graves, but there will be people who are buried there. We recently did a study with ground-penetrating radar, right? And they sort of took a camera, basically, rolled it over the ground, and that's what showed up on the film, those where we have those orange markers. Yeah. So that showed probable grave sites. So we may already have most of this. There were 872 probable grave sites listed here that we see with the orange markers. But keep in mind that over 12,000 African Americans have been buried at Oakland since its founding.
My name is Tamia Lewis. I'm here with my daughter, Anaya Lewis. She's 7. I want her to learn about African American history, learn where our ancestors come from. She's just getting to the age where I feel comfortable introducing her to things and teaching her about, you know, American history, slavery, and things of those nature.
It's pretty sad that people were slaves.
I don't think she can fully grasp it quite yet, but she's slowly learning how serious and how important it is.
You guys want to walk around some more? Or are you ready to go back up? You've been down here a while. You've been down here a couple of hours. So good work. So turn your cultural treasure hunt in back at the table up there, and they'll give you a little keepsake to take with you to remember your day. Thank you for participating in our hunt.
Oakland Cemetery hopes to identify the occupants of nearly 900 unmarked graves, and it has plans to eventually offer visitors GPS coordinates to these sites with detailed information about who's buried in these plots. You can get more info on this project at gpbnews.org. Another thing happening this weekend, Father's Day. So happy Father's Day to all the dads out there. If you haven't decided yet what to get your dad, consider a trip down memory lane. Bea Wynn of Atlanta has taken the time to reflect on how her relationship with her dad has changed over the years, and she shares this dedication to a man who's lived in two different worlds, one as a middle-class dad in America, the other as a poor child in Vietnam.
My dad lives for his jobs. You can tell by his hands. They're spotted, several shades darker than my mom's. They're labored hands, not the ones I picture for either a pharmacist or a chemical engineer. They are more like the hands of a man once jailed in re-education camp in Vietnam in the 70s, starved, condemned to hard labor, and forced by his captors to recite communist doctrine. When I was a child, his presence in our household was marked by the absence of a second car in the garage, the empty space occupied only after my bedtime. From beneath the covers, I listened for the faint thuds of his footsteps, the jostling of his keys, and the bleep of the house alarm, alerting our bilingual dog of his arrival. Bon vert, Roy. My father has always worked two jobs, just like he always votes Republican in federal elections and always mows the lawns on weekends. Last year, he abruptly quit his second gig at the Veterans Hospital, freeing up his Saturdays and Sundays for the first time since I moved away for college. Now, when I make the two-hour drive to my family's house in Augusta, I am startled to see his trusty Honda Accord tightly parked in the cluttered garage. My dad is bored now, his brain dulled by his iPad, his identity ensnared by middle-class America. When he had two jobs, he at least didn't have to worry about finding a hobby like golf, or hiding behind his general distaste for sports, or trying to relate to his five daughters. Instead, he would fill prescriptions, dole out medicine, and stand on his feet for 10 or 12 hours at a time, making it easy to return home and fall asleep on his recliner every night of the week. He has never really enjoyed his work, though. His jobs distracted him from grieving for the parents he left behind in Vietnam, or wondering if his daughters might show him more respect had they been raised more traditionally in his home country. His jobs provided him with titles and accolades he could attach to his name or hang on the walls of his office. Nguyen Nguyen, doctor of pharmacy, or Nguyen Nguyen, chemical engineer. His jobs created for him routine, like the security of putting on his lab coat, name tag fastened near the lapel. But even with 80-hour work weeks, followed by fitful sleep, there were still increments of time my dad could not fill. In these spaces, he told us stories about prison camp and the way he would break up blocks of salt to share with his cellmates, pinching with their fingers portions of white rice given to them twice a day. He recalled with laughter the unbearable hunger, how he would walk the 2 miles to school where he performed at the top of his class, numbing the pain he felt from the shortcomings he could not change. Once he arrived in America at the age of 30, he did the same thing. And with almost no language skills, he managed to graduate in 2.5 years, earning his degree as a chemical engineer. The award, the merit my dad cannot frame for display, is his status as a hero in our eyes. It's the job he can't retire from, the one that will unburden him from the stress of keeping his American identity intact. It pays him far more than any of his advanced degrees, and it can't be stripped away in America or in Vietnam.
Bee Nguyen runs the Atlanta-based nonprofit Athena's Warehouse. It works to empower teenage girls. And we wonder how you plan to celebrate your dad this Father's Day. Tell us your Father's Day plans, or just tell us about your dad at 404-500-9457. You can reach us on Twitter at OST Talk. You know what? It's been a long week. We heard about gun violence research at the CDC. We revisited a conversation with author Alice Walker and learned about some of the unsung female heroes of the civil rights movement. So, as we do every Friday, we have gathered a group of smart people to help us kick back, unwind, and think about what the heck happened this week. It's time for the break room.
Professional wrestling, even on a local level, is built on manufactured drama and conflict. Well, that took one fan to a bad place.
We are going to make America great again.
But he's also making dating great again.
Mr. Noir, this is Buddy Patterson down in Atlanta.
Right.
I'm calling about, well, a tragedy that's taking place in our city. And I refer to the Atlanta Braves!
Today in the break room, we have Amy Condon. She's an editor with Savannah Magazine. Also, environmental blogger Ken Edelstein is back in the break room. It's good to see you again after so long.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Sumaya Khalifa oversees the Islamic Speakers Bureau of Atlanta, and Sam Burnham is with the blog All the Biscuits in Georgia. Welcome to everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Amy, are you there? I don't know if Amy's there. There's no answer from Savannah, but we will get started while we search for Amy.
I can't. I hear classical music.
Oh, hello, Amy. You're on the air there. The National Cathedral in Washington, D.C. says it will remove the Confederate battle flags that are now part of its famous stained glass windows. Those windows memorialize Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson. There are other symbols of the Confederacy on the windows, and those will remain, at least for the time being. The National Cathedral says it will revisit those images later. For now, though, the cathedral wants to use the removal of the battle flags as a starting point for a discussion about race and the history of slavery. So what do we think? Is this a good decision?
Yes, it is.
Why?
Well, people go to a cathedral to worship and to be very focused on God and their spirituality. And to have windows that remind us, a lot of Americans, of the dark part of our history, I think that distracts people. So I believe that it is a good thing for them to remove those windows.
That's an interesting point of view. Ken?
Well, I'd also add that, you know, it's the National Cathedral, which kind of has a special place in American faith at the intersection of American faith and the state, really. Not that, you know, I'm trying to mix state and religion or stuff like that.
Them,
but
yeah.
But you know, to have an this will be controversial, an anti-American rebellious symbols there and to glorify them.
It'd be controversial, but it's factual.
Well, some people might not say it's anti-American, but I do.
Okay. Sam, you want to jump in?
Well, of course, I'm going to disagree with Ken on that point. All the Confederate veterans, none of them were ever tried for treason. Samuel Chase, who was the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court at the time, actually worked hard to make sure none of them did because he didn't believe they would ever be convicted of anything because he didn't believe what they had done was wrong. And I read that from documents at the University of Akron and the University of Rice just last night. But also, all Confederate veterans are considered U.S. veterans by the United States Veterans Administration, and their grave sites are all kept up by the
VA. Okay, but let's return to the removal of the battle flag.
The removal of the battle flag, I would say, the battle flags themselves, I don't get that caught up in that. If they want to remove the flags, okay, but I think the conversation that we need to keep in mind is a similar incident in Roanoke, Virginia, at Fifth Avenue Presbyterian Church in Roanoke. There is a stained glass window of Stonewall Jackson in that church that was placed there by the son of slaves who were in the Sunday school class that Thomas Jackson taught for slaves. And they thought enough of him that when they built their church, they wanted to place a memorial for him in there because they saw him not as a punishment, but as a tyrant or a slave owner, but he saw him as a hero that they wanted to revere.
That seems like more a personal story, though. Let me move on. Amy, we've got you.
Can y'all hear me?
Yes. We got about a minute left. Can you tell me what you think about the removal of the battle flag from the National Cathedral?
I think that's okay. I think that's appropriate, that there's a better place for that conversation to take place, not in, it feels more like a museum piece rather than a spiritual piece. But I think the conversation around it does need to happen.
Okay, well, let's talk about another conversation. There are dating sites for just about everybody. You can find dating sites for farmers, for Christians, geeks even, and now there is a dating site specifically for supporters of this guy.
We have to stop people from pouring into our country. We have to stop it. Until we find out what the hell is going on.
Okay, this is that, of course, is a Republican presidential presumptive nominee, Donald Trump. A guy named David Goss saw this as an opportunity because he started a dating website called TrumpSingles.com. He says that people who are not fans of Donald Trump give Trump supporters a bad name, and therefore it's hard to find dates. What do we think about this? Look, we know that America is polarized. So my question to you guys is, would you date somebody of the opposing political party, whatever that party is?
I would not date Donald Trump. I mean, I just
Donald
think
Trump.
He's
We're talking
too
about his
much
supporters.
Into himself, and I just don't think that he would make for nice, bedtime conversation. Well, that hasn't stopped him before.
Oh, boy. Okay, Sumaya, would you date somebody from the opposite political party?
No, not right now.
No.
Because of the polarization that we're experiencing, it's really bad.
Yeah, it is. Amy?
You know, in the past, I've often dated people from the men from the other political parties, but I have to say that if I were in the dating pool right now, it would give me pause because it would really talk about value systems in a much deeper way.
Well, I think that's true. I mean, it's the question of the shared values, but I mean, you know, there's no such thing as a card-carrying Democrat, I think, in Georgia, or you don't have to register to be a Democrat, but I voted Democrat for quite a while now, and I don't know, I have friends who are Republican, and some of my best friends are Republican, and but the thing is, the question is, like, how far? Because I think, you know, the whole Trump thing, it's like,
you're separating Trump out from Republican.
Right.
Sam, what about you?
I've actually dated people from the other party when I was in college, before I got married. I sort of separate those personal relationships from political ideas because
it's hard these days,
Well, and it can be, but I kind of take that whole Thomas Jefferson approach. I don't let politics and philosophy interfere with my friendships. I have a lot of friends that I disagree with, and we disagree heatedly at times on issues of politics. But when you're dealing with a person, a human being, and you're trying to connect with them on an emotional and personal level, sometimes you got to let some of those other issues go.
That's a question I have for our listeners also. You can let us know if you would have trouble dating somebody from the opposing party. Tweet us at OST Talk. It's Friday. We're in the break room. I'm joined by blogger Sam Burnham of All the Biscuits in Georgia, Sumaya Khalifa of the Islamic Speakers Bureau of Atlanta, environmental blogger Ken Edelstein, and Amy Condon of Savannah Magazine. We'd love to get your input in the break room, like I said, and a special thank you as always to Savannah Coffee Roasters for donating the coffee that is fueling our break room guests this morning. You can find them online at savannahcoffee.com. Okay, a couple minutes ago, we were talking about Donald Trump. And let's continue that because he's had a kind of a tumultuous relationship with the media during this whole election cycle. He recently banned the Washington Post from covering his campaign, but that is hardly the first media outlet. He previously barred Politico, BuzzFeed, the Huffington Post, and a whole long list, actually, of others. Some people say this is an attack on freedom of the press because he's a candidate for the highest office in the nation. Do you agree? Maybe it is simply his right to bar the outlets he thinks are hostile to him.
Well, I guess one of the questions is, does it work? Will it work? Is it a winning tactic or strategy for his campaign?
I don't think people have a lot of fondness. I mean, the average American doesn't have a lot of fondness for the media, right?
Right, right. But I just don't think this is going to work because, one, you know, there's that old saw about you don't upset people who buy ink by the barrel,
yeah.
Yeah, that.
That's a really old saw. Amy, you're with the media. What do you think?
I think this is wrong because when you're the presumptive nominee for a major political party, you have to act presidential. You have to show how you will be as president. And what he's showing is the things he said prior to actually becoming the presumptive nominee. And he's showing that he will bar anyone who writes about him in an unflattering way, whatever he thinks is unflattering. And so you have to have a thicker skin for this high of an office, and you have to be willing to answer questions. And you can't just, I mean, the foundation of a solid democracy, a true democracy, is having also a really strong media. Now, whether the media has done its job is another thing. But just simply
that is
barring them.
Conversation.
Yeah, simply barring them, you're showing us how you would be as a president.
Sumaya, what do you think?
This is what third world dictators do, not in America. So I'm sorry, I really hate what's going on there.
In terms of barring, Sam?
I'm going to say that he has a right to do this. The problem is we're in the middle of an election, and people are going to judge you and their vote based on how you behave. And if you aren't taking an honest approach and allowing yourself to be open to multiple views of the media, then can we consider this to be a viable candidate? And do we really want to just see Donald Trump in his end this candidacy instead of a press conference, just having a Breitbart reporter over to have supper with him? I mean, that,
you know, nobody's saying that he doesn't have a right to do this. He has a right to do, you know, whatever he wants to as long as it's legal. But yeah, it's not very presidential, and you know, he's just jumping from one disaster to the next. And
exactly.
If you look at the polls over the last 2 weeks, it was sort of looking like it tightened up. Maybe Hillary had a 2 or 3 percentage rose, but now she's like 8% ahead, according to
the
polls.
That could be any number of reasons, though.
Any number of Trump's mess-ups over the last 2 weeks might be doing it.
And if he keeps doing stuff like this, it's only a matter of time till Gary Johnson comes in and says, you know, vote for
Gary
Donald
Johnson
Trump.
Gary Johnson of the Libertarian Party.
Right.
Yeah.
He says, vote for Donald Trump is a vote for Hillary Clinton, so vote for me. So when does that happen?
All right. Well, since we're talking about sharing things, let's keep the conversation going on social media. I wonder if you're the parent of a teenager, like Sam is, maybe somebody who constantly uses social media?
I posted a pic on Insta and only got like 3 likes. I'm literally dying.
Okay, research from the University.
Literally dying.
Research from the University of California shows that teens are actually more likely to do dangerous things if they've seen pictures of them that were liked on social media. And some experts now argue maybe we need to restrict social media use as we do with things like driving, voting, smoking, and drinking alcohol. What do we? Let me start with you, Sam, because you have your kid with you.
And he's sort of this exception to many of the teenage rules. I've even asked him, do you want social media? He doesn't want to be on there because the only thing he'll do is like YouTube, and he's watching these videos. He's going, these kids are dumb. Why would you
like
risk
kid.
Getting yourself hurt or whatever? And so I think what you have here is we need to be working more as parents. And mm-hmm. I'm not taking a bunch of credit mm-hmm. for this because it's just the kid's personality on a lot of it. But we need to teach them to be
responsible.
So
not restrict it. Not
and,
restrict, just have
right,
more prayer.
Where does our parental responsibility come in instead of the government having to make a rule telling us how
Okay, well, libertarian, hate rules.
Yeah, but and I wouldn't consider myself a libertarian, but I have to, I mean, how do you regulate something like that? That seems just like a slippery slope where, I don't know, you know, you can restrict your kid from doing certain things, I suppose, but for the government to do it?
Sumaya, Amy?
Yeah.
Well,
Go ahead, Amy.
Oh, well, I was. How are we teaching critical thinking and how to make choices that are good for you and not so healthy for you? And if you just keep restricting things and sort of making this sort of safe world, you know, we're not going to have people who know how to think. And so I think those are opportunities for sort of object lessons and teaching moments. But I agree with the, you know, you have to have a hand in it as a parent to sort of navigate those waters and say, you know, here's appropriate use of it. Here's not appropriate use of it.
Since we're talking about things that are appropriate and things are not, there's another headline about teenagers and something else they like to do, which is party.
You guys up for a toga party?
Toga! Toga!
Yeah, I think they like the idea, Hoof.
Oh, Otter, please don't do this.
Toga, 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 toga.
Okay, so officers were recently called to a teen house party in Richmond County, Georgia. So get this, there were about 700 people packed in and around a single home.
Cool,
yeah.
Man.
And police officers are now saying, look, take heed, summer is the season for big teen parties. And I wondered which of you threw a huge teen party when you were in high school or college? And what was the, or if you didn't throw them, what was the biggest party you've ever gone to? So, Amy, we'll start with you.
Okay, I'm trying to remember. I didn't really party until I got to college. So, and I have to say probably the largest party I went to was a toga party at a frat house.
We're going to need pictures of that, Sam.
I was sort of quiet in high school, but then I went to a
you
party
quiet?
School. I attended a school that's known as a party school, and we did throw a birthday party for one of my roommates. We had a house together and a good-sized yard, and we I'm going to guess we probably had closer to 100 rather than 700, but what I thought was the funniest, the only thing I drank that night was coffee, but I drank a whole pot and wound up with the shakes, and then we actually wound up being shut down by the police because the fraternity that was behind us called in a noise complaint because their party got shut down, and they were mad that we were still having ours. So they called the police, and we had to shut down.
Ken?
Y'all should have just combined parties.
Right, I know. Sore losers. But, I don't remember throwing any really big parties even in high school or even in college. But after we got out of college, my friend and I lived in Washington, D.C. for a couple of years, and I do remember us standing up and barely standing at the end of it, and Paul and I saying to each other, self-congratulatory, we had just thrown the greatest party in the history of Washington, D.C., and then later waking up.
I feel like that needs confirmation, but
and,
go ahead.
And he was in bed with me, and his girlfriend was looking at us and saying, Paul, what are you doing in Ken's bed?
Okay, we're going to end that story because I feel like it's not going anywhere good.
It didn't go anywhere. Okay. It didn't go anywhere.
Sumai, so your last one hasn't shared some riotous story.
Well, my story is that in high school, I had slumber parties with girls. And the funniest thing that we did was call people late at night, just random numbers.
You prank called people.
Yes. And said...
You're a bad girl.
Well, it was a dare. And we said,
is
your
refrigerator dangerous?
You said?
We'd say, is your refrigerator running? And they would say yes. And we'll say, well, you better go catch it.
So you
and
crank all... called people with dad jokes. That yes. just makes it.
Do you have Prince Albert in a can?
We are hanging out in the break room with Sumaya Khalifa of the Islamic Speakers Bureau, Sam Burnham of All the Biscuits in Georgia, Ken Edelstein, a blogger, and Amy Condon of Savannah Magazine. Okay. Neil Cassidy, by the way, tweets river bottom parties in Oklahoma. I don't know if those are legendary or something. We need more details there, Neil.
The evidence gets flooded away.
Oh, God, more dad jokes. Okay, let's move on. Speaking of dad jokes, Garrison Keillor. He's the host of Public Radio's A Prairie Home Companion. He recently weighed in a big way on the Braves' move to Cobb County. Mm. Keillor performed a show in Atlanta for the last time, and in typical Prairie Home fashion, he included a bit where he criticized the Braves' decision to leave Turner Field.
What I called you about, Mr. Right. Ward, this season is the team's last season in its beloved Turner Field.
No.
One of the most beautiful ballparks in the history of baseball.
Uh-huh.
Next spring, unless the good people of Georgia come to their senses, the team will leave its home in the great American city of Atlanta, a city with history,
right.
culture,
yeah.
and go to an ugly new field in the midst of miles of shopping malls and office parks.
Okay, so in addition to that, Deadspin reports that Cobb County will have to raise taxes in order to pay for public parks, just as that $400 million new stadium nears completion. So I'm wondering how we're all feeling about the Braves. Oh boy, Sam's already giving me the stink eye.
You need to take a picture of that and post it so I can see what that looks like from Savannah.
We just toured Turner Field with my son's class a few weeks ago. And I'm looking around wondering, why in the world do we need to replace this ball field? There's nothing wrong with it. It's, you know, this whole competition where we want to get the All-Star Game, or with Georgia Dome, we want to get the Super Bowl.
Mm-hmm.
And you think that the Superdome hosts more Super Bowls than the Georgia Dome, and it was older than the Georgia Dome is now when Georgia Dome was built.
You're talking about the Superdome in New
Orleans.
Right,
the Superdome in New Orleans. It's not a matter of just get a brand new stadium and we get this event that will never in any way pay for the money and the time and the trouble it took to build a new stadium. And, you know, Boston's playing in Fenway Park that they've been playing in since the early 1900s.
Right, and those are great experiences at Fenway Park and Finley. But, you know, this whole deal that Liberty Media had to abandon a historic Olympic stadium, you know, it stinks to high heaven. And Commissioner Lee is in real trouble in Cobb County as a result of this. And the folks who live around there, I think we got somebody here who does, are going to be dealing with a lot more traffic. And I think the city's going to have just fine redevelopment but in that area. But it's bad for... you know, a lot of reasons, and particularly for Cobb County, it seems to me.
Well, I'm a resident of Cobb County, and I'm dreading it. I live like 2 miles away from the new stadium.
Oof.
And,
traffic is bad
already, and we have no idea what it's going to be like once they move in there. And then talking about taxes, increasing taxes, come on, give me a break. And I really would hate to leave the old stadium because it has such historic moments such as Muhammad Ali lighting the flame for the Olympics, etc.
Well, let me read you a tweet from a listener, T-Barf. He tweets, I found that Prairie Home segment to be very unfunny. Not sure why lefties have politicized the Braves move. That said, it was a bonehead move.
I take offense to that because I'm about as far from a lefty as you're going to find.
No, but he did seem like, I mean, I felt like when I heard that, you know, what you Yankees coming down here telling us about how all this stuff and you know, kind of insulting Cobb County in the process.
Don't like to do what we're told. All right. So
let me
just say, though. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I was just going to say that if you're going to invest additional taxes in something, one of the best returns on your investment are public parks. So,
and not stadiums.
There you go. All right, and we got this tweet from Robbie Medwed, who says, "Said it before, I'll say it again. The Braves are dead to me." Dead. Okay, we only have a couple minutes left, and we'll see if we can get through this last topic in that time. During a wrestling match this month in Catoosa County, Georgia, a woman in the audience brought a gun to the fight and pointed it at one of the fighters, the quote-unquote bad guy of the wrestling match. According to the Times Free Press, Patricia Ann Crowe was charged with aggravated assault and reckless conduct. And the question is, should we add wrestling matches to the list of places where people should not be allowed to carry a gun?
No, it should be a place where everybody is required to carry a gun because, see, if the bad guy wrestler had a gun, then she wouldn't have ever drawn her gun.
See? Yeah, come on now. You've been, what did you call it, Sam? It's a wrestling.
It's different than wrestling, which is like what they do in the college and the Olympics.
Yes.
This is wrestling, which is a little bit of a different creature. And if you've never been to a local wrestling event, and seen, you need to go. Everybody go once. You know, you'll pay you a couple dollars to get in. You don't have to ever go again. But watch with the grannies on the front row swinging at the bad guys with their canes. That they don't need a gun to get rowdy up in a wrestling match in North Georgia.
So you're for banning guns there?
I actually think okay. As far as the guns, let's leave that up to the person that owns or operates the venue. But grannies are dangerous.
She looks dangerous from the picture.
Enough is enough of gun violence. We need to stop that.
Wrestling matches or anywhere else?
Anywhere else.
Amy? Yes.
I agree with the last statement completely. I think we've also bordered on this weirdness where it's, I don't know if it's reality TV or what's done it, but where we assume that someone's portraying a character is really that character.
Oh, yes.
And you know what I mean?
Like,
remember you were talking about critical thinking?
Yes, the whole concept of critical thinking is kind of like blown out the door, and that gives me more concern than anything.
Okay, so Amy Condon is concerned that people think that fantasy is reality. Sumaya just wants us to get better gun control, and Sam Burnham wants to ban grannies, apparently. We are out of time.
All the brave old ladies from Pasadena had to go somewhere.
We're out of time in the break room. I want to say thank you to all my guests. Amy Condon is an editor with Savannah Magazine. Sumaya
Thanks
Khalifa
so much.
Oversees, you're welcome, as the Islamic Speakers Bureau of Atlanta. Sam Burnham runs the blog All the Biscuits in Georgia. And Ken Edelstein blogs about the environment. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. But as always, we love to hear from you. And we'd especially love to hear your answer on that question. Should we allow guns at wrestling matches? I'm not saying that right. Call us at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter at OST Talk and on Facebook. For today and the week, that's on Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day. Still hot, knock your shell off. My money stacked fat, plus I can't turn the swell off. The franchise doing big business. I live this, it's automatic. I win this, so you hear those horns, you finish. A soldier, and I stay under you fighting for some storm.